Good morning. It's Tuesday, the 28th of October, and you're listening to the Wall Street Journal here on Sun Sounds of Arizona. This is your volunteer reader and Flagstaff, Chuck Kaufman, bringing you these headlines from the front page of the Wall Street Journal. Good vibes for stocks return, fueled by earnings, trade talk. Five finalists named for Fed's top spot, and Milei's victory unlocks windfall on Wall Street. Our first article by Hannah Aaron Lang and Ben Glickman, Good Vibes for Stocks Return, Fueled by Earnings, Trade Talk. All three major indexes hit records and overseas markets rally too. From trade deals and foreign elections to merger announcements to corporate earnings, investors are finding plenty of reasons to be happy. Stocks hit fresh records on Monday, marking a significant pickup in momentum after a bumpy stretch in which tariff fears and worries about loan losses at regional banks weighed on major indexes. The optimism isn't limited to U.S. markets. Benchmarks in Japan, South Korea, and Taiwan notched records Monday, while the Shanghai Composite Index closed at its highest level in more than 10 years. Argentine stocks rocketed 22% higher, powered by a decisive political win for President Javier Milei in the country's midterm elections. "There's just a lot of stuff in the good column and not a lot in the bad column," said Jed Ellerbach, portfolio manager at Argent Capital Management. All three major stock indexes hit records on Monday, with tech companies leading the charge. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained around 337 points, or 0.7%. The S&P 500 added 1.2%. The NASDAQ Composite Index rose 1.9%, notching back-to-back gains greater than 1% for the first time since May. Stocks were lifted by hopes for improving trade relations between the U.S. and China. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent said there was a very successful framework for President Trump and President Xi Jinping to discuss Thursday, while a senior Chinese official said the two sides had reached a preliminary consensus on key issues. The good mood marks a reversal from just a few weeks ago, when a social media post from Trump threatening higher tariffs against China sent stocks tumbling. The S&P 500 and NASDAQ Composite both had their worst days since April. The abrupt bankruptcies of auto parts manufacturer First Brands and the subprime auto lender Tricolor, along with a $50 million loan charge-off by Zions Bancorp, raised worries that a humming credit market has concealed pockets of weakness. But worries eased and stock indexes recovered, with investors appearing more than happy to take the latest yo-yoing update on trade in stride, analysts said. Investors have had no choice but to get comfortable with President Trump's negotiating style and his preference for doing trade deals publicly, Ellerbrook said. "You just have to accept that if you're going to own large-cap tech stocks, you're subject to daily surprises." Traders have also been reassured by a strong start to earnings season. Though crucial economic data releases like the October jobs report have been delayed due to the government shutdown, better-than-expected profits at major companies have assuaged concerns about the health of the U.S. economy. A flurry of corporate deal-making also has juiced optimism. Sunday and Monday brought a cluster of larger deal announcements, stoking investor glee over an easier environment for big company tie-ups. Regional bank Huntington Bancshares said it would acquire Southern counterpart Cadence for $7.4 billion in stock, the latest example of consolidation among lenders. Meanwhile, large water utilities, American Water and Essential Utilities, agreed to merge in an all-stock deal valuing the smaller Essential at some $12 billion, excluding debt, and on Sunday, Novartis announced a $12 billion acquisition of biotech Avidity Biosciences. The regulatory environment is constructive, not just for the banking industry, Huntington Chief Executive Steve Steinor said in an interview. "The policies of this administration are very pro-U.S. growth. The total value of U.S. transactions is up about 36% so far this year from the previous period to about $1.6 trillion, according to LSEG, boosted by a surge in transactions valued at over $5 billion. The days ahead will bring more crucial updates for investors. More than one-third of the companies in the S&P 500 are set to report quarterly earnings in the coming days, including big names like Apple, Meta, and Alphabet. On Wednesday afternoon, the Federal Reserve is scheduled to announce its latest move on interest rates. Investors are widely expecting another cut. Shares of American companies are piling on gains in what has already been a very good year on Wall Street, lifted by a resilient economic backdrop. The S&P 500 is up about 17% year-to-date after rebounding sharply from the turmoil following the Trump administration's tariff announcement in April. Some worry the enthusiasm is running a little too hot. Skeptics point to signs of froth that might suggest the rally is unsustainable. Traders are snapping up shares of leveraged stock funds and struggling companies at the same time that they have piled into gold. Billions of dollars have been pouring into funding a build-out of AI infrastructure, but it remains unclear how and when the return on that enormous investment will materialize. People are sort of whistling past the graveyard of some real risks out there for the economy, said Dean Smith, chief strategist at Folio Beyond. That is troubling. And that's Good Vibes for Stocks Return, fueled by earnings and trade talk. Our next article, five finalists named for Fed's top spot. President says he's looking to decide on Powell's successor by the end of this year. And this is by Nick Timoreos. The Trump administration has narrowed the list of candidates to succeed Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell to five, and the president said he's aiming to make a decision by the end of the year. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent plans to conduct a second round of interviews with the current slate next month before presenting an even shorter list of nominees to the president to consider. The five include two sitting Fed governors who were initially nominated to the central bank's board by Trump, Christopher Waller and Michelle Bowman, who's also the vice chair for bank supervision, Bessent said Monday. Both Bessent and Trump made their comments to reporters traveling on Air Force One. Two candidates are widely seen as frontrunners, Kevin Hassett, who is the director of the White House National Economic Council, and Kevin Warsh, a former Fed governor nominated by George W. Bush. Rick Reeder, a senior executive at BlackRock who oversees the firm's massive bond business, rounds out the five. Trump has previously said he isn't considering Bessent for the job, and he repeated that view Monday. Still, several people who have spoken with Bessent said they believe he could still emerge as a contender for the role if Trump isn't satisfied with the other options. Besides Bessent, Warsh and Hassett have cultivated the closest relationships with Trump, which many Fed watchers believe will be a crucial factor in arguably the most consequential personnel decision for the remainder of Trump's term. Trump, a Republican, has previously said he was considering Hassett, Waller, and Warsh for the job. Reeder impressed Bessent during an initial conversation about the position this summer, according to people familiar with the matter. The president's frustration with Powell's reluctance to cut interest rates this summer prompted him to toy with the idea of selecting and announcing a replacement much sooner, by September or October, the Wall Street Journal previously reported. But in August, the White House was unexpectedly able to fill a vacancy after Adriana Kugler, an appointee of former President Joe Biden, resigned her seat around 6 months early. The Senate confirmed Stephen Miran, an economic advisor to Trump, in September. Around the same time, Bessent embarked on a strategy that slowed down the process of naming a new chair by conducting interviews with 11 candidates whose names were floated in the press. The atypically public vetting process prompted several of the contenders to add their voices to the debate over monetary policy, which served as a way for Bessent to amplify arguments that would support the case for bigger Fed rate cuts. The Fed cut interest rates in September by a quarter point, though Moran dissented in favor of a larger half-point reduction. The Fed is widely expected to cut rates by another quarter point at its two-day meeting that concludes Wednesday. Historically, the White House has announced a new chair around 3 to 4 months before the expiration of the sitting Fed leader's term. An early announcement could allow a chair in waiting to influence investor expectations about the likely path for interest rates. But an unusually premature announcement would carry drawbacks by potentially putting Powell's successor in the awkward spot of publicly challenging his or her future colleagues, or alternately, defending the Fed's moves, upsetting Trump. Interest rate decisions are steered and influenced by the chair, but they must be agreed upon by a broader committee of 12 officials, the 7 presidentially appointed governors, and a rotating group of 5 Fed bank presidents. Trump's choice for Fed chair is likely to fill the Fed board seat currently held by Moran. Moran's term ends in January, but he can remain on the board pending the confirmation of a successor by the Senate. That would allow Trump to seat the future Fed chair for rate-setting meetings in March and April ahead of the new chair's term that begins in mid-May. And that's 5 finalists named for Fed's top spot. Our next article, Milei's victory unlocks windfall on Wall Street. This is by Alexander Saidi, Justin Baer, and Jack Pitcher. Wall Street has bet repeatedly that Argentina would break its cycle of fiscal crises only to end up regretting it. The country's election results revived hopes that this time might be different. President Javier Milei's resounding win brought a sense of relief to investors, banks, and even taxpayers who had all something to lose on Sunday. But Argentina's fight to find its financial footing is far from over. The peso rose around 4% against the U.S. dollar. A dollar-denominated government bond maturing in 2046 rose by 11 cents to trade at about 67 cents on the dollar, according to TradeWeb data. Argentina's benchmark stock index, the Merval, closed up 22%. Mutual and hedge funds have benefited from the bond's rally and are poised for bigger gains should Milei make good on his plans to turn around Argentina's economy. A U.S. bailout intended to stabilize the country's finances is also now more likely to proceed, which could help the country shore up its dwindling available foreign exchange reserves, which it needs to make billions of dollars of foreign debt payments next year. But big questions remained about how the U.S. can firm up its support in the form of a $20 billion currency swap and a separate $20 billion private debt facility, people familiar with the matter said. Funds from the swap line haven't yet been disbursed as Treasury officials debate what collateral from Argentina can be used to shield U.S. taxpayers from losses, the people said. And the U.S. has also bought over $1 billion of pesos to help defend the currency in recent weeks, they said, effectively tying U.S. taxpayers directly to the fate of South America's second largest economy. A spokesman for the Treasury Department didn't return requests for comment. U.S. mutual and exchange-traded funds held around $5 billion of Argentina's sovereign debt as of last week, according to Morningstar Direct, with the likes of PIMCO, Fidelity, and BlackRock among the largest owners. Hedge funds are also known to trade Argentine assets. High yields and volatile market moves attract those willing to take risks to make big profits. And Argentina's relatively large markets compared with other developing nations make it easier to enter and exit big positions. Global investors will probably increase their allocation, and that should result in a very sustained, significant rally for the next days, weeks, maybe until the end of the year, said Thierry Larousse, an emerging market debt portfolio manager for Vontobel. LaRose said his firm had been buying pesos and dollar-denominated bonds in the run-up to the election. Argentina has long been a flashpoint in global finance. The South American country's repeated assurance that its volatile economy had regained its footing were often too alluring to the U.S. banks and investors eager to profit from a potential turnaround. Instead, a trail of defaults and currency devaluations often left foreign lenders chastened. at least until the next set of promised overhauls and the potential for juicy returns lured them back again. Wall Street had reached those crossroads again with Milei, whose agenda of slashing government spending and regulations offered hope that Argentina was stabilizing. Sunday's midterm elections cast international investors in a familiar position, hoping for the best but preparing for the worst. On Monday, some investors thought the election results could allow Argentina to return to the global markets to borrow on its own next year, though doubts remained about its policy of defending the peso, which has costed billions of dollars in foreign exchange reserves. The risk is, of course, that Argentina's policymakers will think that the combination of Milei's political victory and U.S. support will allow them to continue with a strong peso policy, even though Argentina lacks the external balance sheet to support it, said Brad Setzer, a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. Some investors had crowded into trades involving Argentina's U.S. dollar-denominated government bonds ahead of the election. These bonds are most likely to pay off should the U.S. come through with bailout facilities or if Argentina returned to the bond market. Another key incentive was an announcement from the Milei administration last week to buy back sovereign bonds through a debt swap program managed by J.P. Morgan Chase. The U.S. bailout plans remain a work in progress, people familiar with the matter said. President Trump signaled that the terms and size of the bailout would depend on how well Milei's party did in Sunday's election. The Treasury Department announced plans to swap $20 billion for a similar amount of pesos. U.S. officials said it would use the Treasury's rainy day facility called the Exchange Stabilization Fund to finance the swap. In unveiling the framework for the currency swap, Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent disclosed in a social media post that the U.S. had also made direct purchases of pesos to act swiftly to help pull the currency out of a moment of acute illiquidity. Banks including J.P. Morgan, Citigroup, and Santander have helped facilitate the interventions to support the peso, people familiar with the matter said. The Trump administration had also tapped J.P. Morgan, Bank of America, and other large U.S. banks to create a $20 billion loan facility, the Wall Street Journal reported. The would-be financiers have struggled to find common ground on what they would accept as collateral to make their credit risks more palatable, the Journal reported. That's Milei's victory unlocks windfall on Wall Street. Next up, we have, in Asia, Trump aims to seal deals. This is by Jason Douglas in Tokyo, Timothy W. Martin in Seoul, and Shan Lee in New Delhi. President Trump's quest to reorder global trade through personal diplomacy will be tested during his tour of Asia this week as he faces the tantalizing prospect of a pact with China and the chance to bust through obstacles to completing deals with other key trading partners. On Sunday, Trump won some momentum by winning tariff agreements with a handful of Southeast Asian nations. He also sounded an optimistic note on China ahead of a meeting with Chinese leader Xi Jinping planned for later this week. "I think we're going to come away with a deal," Trump said Monday, aboard Air Force One en route to Japan. Trump is scheduled to be in the region through Thursday. As well as a high-stakes meeting with Xi, Trump is due to meet Japan's new prime minister, Sanae Takaichi, on Tuesday to discuss trade and security issues, and will sit down with South Korean President Lee Jae-myung on Wednesday. There's much ground left to cover with other important Asian economies, including South Korea, India, Australia, and Taiwan. In some instances, negotiators are struggling to turn bare-bones agreements into actionable deals, while other talks are continuing. Completing more trade deals would bolster Trump's centerpiece trade agenda as his controversial levies face legal and political blowback at home and abroad. More delays, despite Trump's direct involvement, could embolden other countries to dig in longer in the hope of winning more concessions. "Trump needs to show that he's winning," said Carlos Casanova, senior economist for Asia at Union Bancaire Privé, a private bank. Illustrating the challenge is South Korea, which appeared to tap the brakes on a swift finalization of the deal it struck with Washington earlier this year. A senior aide to South Korea's president on Monday said a deal was unlikely when Trump meets Lee in South Korea later this week. The two countries agreed in late July that Seoul would invest $350 billion in the U.S. in return for Washington's agreement to lower its tariffs on South Korean autos and many other goods to 15% from 25%. But the two sides have struggled to bridge the differences over how the investment pledge will work, with Trump at one point insisting the money be paid up front rather than on a project-by-project basis, similar to the Japan deal. To some economists, such wrinkles show the perils of Trump's preference for announcing a bold agreement and leaving the nitty-gritty till later. These deals do still feel quite performative, said Gaurav Ganguly, head of international economics at Moody's Analytics. Still, Trump has signaled a breakthrough with South Korea. It is pretty close to being finalized, he said aboard Air Force One en route to Malaysia. If they have it ready, I'm ready. Trump landed in Japan on Monday for an audience with Emperor Naruhito. He is due to discuss trade, defense, and other issues with Takeuchi at a summit scheduled for Tuesday. Japan's stance is one of the Trump administration's trade successes. Tokyo has agreed to invest $550 billion in the U.S. over the next few years in exchange for a tariff of 15% on most U.S. imports from Japan, including cars. Under the terms of the agreement, the U.S. has a considerable role in identifying projects for Japan to finance, and Tokyo agreed that the U.S. can take 90% of the profits from its investments once the original outlay has been recouped. Trump administration officials, shortly after unleashing proposed tariffs on dozens of countries this spring, said they wanted to give priority to quick deals with five countries: Australia, India, Japan, South Korea, and the UK. The UK reached a rapid agreement in which the U.S. rolled back tariffs to 10% in exchange for British purchases of U.S. airplanes and food. Most goods from Australia, which runs a trade deficit with the U.S., are also subject to a 10% tariff, but a deal appears distant. Australian Trade Minister Don Farrell has said the government believes the U.S. should remove the tariffs altogether, but acknowledged it could take time. India is also proving tough. Prime Minister Narendra Modi skipped a potential face-to-face meeting with Trump over the weekend in Malaysia, opting to virtually attend the Regional Association of Southeast Asian Nations summit. Trade negotiations between New Delhi and Washington had been underway for months when Trump dropped a bomb. The U.S. would impose a 50% tariff on India, partly as punishment for India's continued purchase of discounted Russian oil. Modi is facing increasing domestic pressure to hammer out an agreement as exports of Indian goods to the U.S. have plunged since the tariffs went into effect over the summer. In September, the first full month under Washington's 50% tariffs, India's exports to the U.S. fell to $5.5 billion, down 20% from August and nearly 40% from May, according to Ajay Srivastava, founder of New Delhi consulting firm Global Trade Research Initiative. Taiwan is continuing to seek a lower tariff rate with the U.S. after getting a temporary reduction from a proposed 32% to 20%, which took effect August the 7th. Officials have rejected a U.S. proposal to evenly split Taiwanese semiconductor production at home and in the U.S. Taiwan President Lei Ching-te said last week that concrete results on trade talks could be delivered soon. And that's in Asia. Trump aims to seal deals. Our next article is from the opinion page of the Wall Street Journal. The editorial board writes, Xi gives Trump a Taiwan test. President Trump and Xi Jinping will meet in South Korea on Thursday, and most media attention is on trade. But Mr. Xi has another agenda, which is to coax Mr. Trump to weaken American support for the democracy of Taiwan. Secretary of State Marco Rubio said over the weekend that Americans shouldn't worry that the administration is going to get favorable treatment on trade in exchange for walking away from Taiwan. No one is contemplating that. Good to hear. Mr. Xi's big ask has been that the U.S. formally oppose independence for Taiwan. The current U.S. policy is deliberate ambiguity. It acknowledges China's position that there is one China and that Taiwan is part of it, but doesn't endorse that policy. This isn't a pedantic distinction. Mr. Xi, not unlike Vladimir Putin with Ukraine, aims to condition the world to his narrative that Taiwan is a rogue province so he can subdue 23 million free people on an island the Chinese Communist Party has never ruled. The U.S. doesn't need to clarify its policy on whether it would defend Taiwan in a crisis, but a concession to Mr. Xi on independence would be self-defeating for Mr. Trump's goals. Mr. Trump wants the island to spend more on its defense, but endorsing Mr. Xi's view would undermine morale and tell the Taiwanese that attempting to defend itself is futile. That's what Beijing wants Taipei to conclude. The practical effect would be to erode deterrence as the U.S. weathers a nadir in military power in this decade. It'd be a show of weakness that invites conflict, which was a GOP critique when Biden's Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, said in 2023 that we do not support Taiwanese independence. The Taiwan Relations Act of 1979 says any effort to determine the future of Taiwan by other than peaceful means, including by boycotts or embargoes, would be of grave concern to the United States. Only China is resorting to intimidation in the Strait, not Taiwan. Mr. Rubio's remarks suggest the president understands all this. But anything can happen with Mr. Trump in a room with Mr. Xi. And the U.S. president often muses that Taiwan is a mere mark on the map thousands of miles away from America. Taiwan passes every test for a U.S. interest, from raw geopolitics to core values. It is part of the first Pacific island chain that forms the U.S. security perimeter against Beijing's ambitions. Too few politicians are pressing that case to the public. But for this week, Mr. Trump can make a donation to world peace by refusing Mr. Xi's demands to sell out Taiwan. That Xi gives Trump a Taiwan test, an article from the opinion page of the Wall Street Journal. You're listening to the Wall Street Journal here on Sun Sounds of Arizona with your volunteer reader, Chuck Kaufman. Remember, you can listen to Sun Sounds of Arizona programming, such as the Wall Street Journal, streaming, or at a time of your choosing by going to the Sun Sounds of Arizona website at sunsounds.org or by downloading the Sun Sounds of Arizona app, available from the Apple App Store for your iPhone or iPad, or the Google Play Store for your Android phone or tablet. And of course, you can always listen to Sun Sounds of Arizona streaming on your Amazon Dot or Echo. Turning now to the business and finance section of the Wall Street Journal, we have these headlines: Amazon to lay off up to 30,000. Qualcomm unveils AI chips to rival NVIDIA's. And U.S. rare earth companies are luring investors. Our first headline by Sean McLean: Amazon to lay off up to 30,000. Cuts could amount to roughly 10% of online giant's white-collar workforce. Amazon.com plans to lay off as many as 30,000 employees starting as early as Tuesday, according to people familiar with the matter. The latest cost-cutting move for the tech giant that is seeking to slim down and conserve cash. The job cuts, which won't all happen this week, would amount to roughly 10% of the online giant's corporate workforce, the people said. Thousands of corporate pink slips are expected to go out Tuesday, cutting across the organization and hitting human resources, cloud computing, advertising, and a number of other business units, the people said. The total number of reductions hasn't been finalized, one of the people said. Amazon's job cuts come as large companies in the U.S. are looking at ways to reduce or slow the growth of their headcount, including by employing artificial intelligence. Rising prices, a tighter labor market, and the ebb and flow of President Trump's trade war have led corporate leaders to look at ways to tighten belts without hurting growth. Amazon chief executive Andy Jassy has been on a years-long campaign to cut expenses as the company ramped up spending on AI in the face of increased competition for its cloud computing business. Reuters earlier reported the number of job cuts. The latest round of job cuts would be the largest since 2022, when Amazon eliminated around 27,000 roles. That layoff occurred in waves. The company views the cuts in part as an effort to correct an aggressive hiring period during the pandemic, the people said. During that period, a boom in online shopping led Amazon to double its warehouse network over a two-year period, an expansion that created both blue and white-collar positions. Amazon CEO Jassy has sought to find ways for the company to do more with less. In June, Jassy sent a note to employees that said increasing use of artificial intelligence will eliminate the need for certain jobs. He called generative AI a once-in-a-lifetime technological change that's already altering how Amazon deals with customers and other businesses and how it conducts its own operations, including job cuts. As we roll out more generative AI and agents, it should change the way our work is done, he said at the time. But in the next few years, we expect that this will reduce our total corporate workforce. Amazon is due to report financial results for the third quarter on Thursday. More big companies are betting they can grow without hiring. JPMorgan Chase's chief financial officer told investors recently that the bank now has a very strong bias against having the reflective response to hire more people. Aerospace and defense company RTX boasted last week that its sales rose even without adding employees. Goldman Sachs sent a memo to staffers this month saying the firm will constrain headcount growth through the end of the year and reduce roles that could be more efficient with AI. Walmart, the nation's largest private employer, has said it plans to keep its headcount roughly flat over the next 3 years, even as its sales grow. Earlier this month, Amazon showed off how investments in robots and AI could help drive down costs, boosting sales without the need for as many human workers. A robot arm called BlueJay is expected to enable Amazon to build smaller warehouses in urban areas where it couldn't previously operate. The company is also experimenting with using AI tools to predict what customers might want to buy and suggest items to add to a shopping basket. Despite straddling businesses as diverse as retail and live sports broadcasting, Amazon's market capitalization of more than $2 trillion is increasingly reliant on its AI prowess. Amazon has been punished by investors after appearing to lag behind many of its competitors in the AI race. In July, the company reported sharp increases in sales and profit for the second quarter, but slower growth in its cloud computing business than Microsoft's and Google's. Amazon shares fell 7% as a result. In a note to clients following the results, Bernstein said, "Amazon's results raised uncomfortable questions about whether the company should be considered an AI winner or a laggard." The company said its capital expenditures rose $31.4 billion for the period, most of which went to AI and cloud computing investments. At the time, Amazon said the figure was reasonably representative of its planned spending for the rest of the year. And that's Amazon to lay off up to 30,000. We turn now to Qualcomm unveils AI chips to rival NVIDIA's. This article is by Robbie Whalen and Gareth Vipers. Qualcomm said it's launching new artificial intelligence and accelerator chips to rival NVIDIA, sending its shares up 11% on Monday. The AI200 will start shipping next year and the AI250 in 2027, the company said. Both will be available as standalone components or cards that can be added to existing machines. The move puts Qualcomm, which is so far mostly focused on semiconductors for mobile devices, in direct competition with NVIDIA, which has dominated the market for AI chips. Qualcomm joins Intel and Advanced Micro Devices in trying to mount AI chip competition against the semiconductor giant. Durga Maladi, A senior vice president of Qualcomm said that the processors represent the natural evolution of the company's product line. The company has developed a strong lineup of device-based chips and now wants to scale up its capabilities for AI data centers. Qualcomm said the AI200 and AI250 have an edge because of their memory capabilities and energy efficiency. We're bringing customers extremely high memory bandwidth and extremely low power consumption, Malady said. It is the best of both worlds. Qualcomm is trying to break into the growing market for AI software and services. The demand for AI processing power is sparking a modern-day gold rush, with technology and power companies pumping hundreds of billions of dollars into the sector. Large companies or hyperscalers such as Amazon.com and Microsoft could easily spend about $3 trillion by 2030 to build and operate data centers for their businesses, according to BlackRock Investment Institute. This month, OpenAI and chip designer AMD announced a multi-billion dollar partnership to collaborate on AI data centers that will run on AMD processors, marking one of the most direct challenges yet to NVIDIA. Troubled chipmaker Intel has also made recent inroads into data center computing by working with NVIDIA to design its first data center CPUs, or central processing units, the computer brains that power most servers. The first customer for the AI200 chips will be Humane, an AI company established by the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia's Public Investment Fund, Qualcomm said. Humane plans to deploy 200 megawatts worth of the chips next year at Saudi data centers to be used mainly for inference computing or the functions that allow AI models to respond to queries. The deal expands upon a partnership between Qualcomm and Humane announced in May during President Trump's visit to a Saudi-U.S. investment forum in the capital of Riyadh. Humane also announced a partnership with NVIDIA at the same event, which involves Humane deploying 500 megawatts of power and purchasing hundreds of thousands of servers powered by NVIDIA's Grace Blackwell chips, its most advanced semiconductors currently on the market. And that's Qualcomm unveils AI chips to rival NVIDIA's. Our next article, U.S. rare earth companies are luring investors. This is by John Emont. A cascade of billion-dollar deals is reshaping the once dormant Western critical minerals industry, which the U.S. and its allies hope will act as a bulwark against aggressive trade practices by China. Since China began restricting exports of rare earths in April, causing auto factories to halt production and rare earth prices to shoot up, a wave of private and government funding has flowed into rare earth companies. They now have money to hire technical experts, expand plants, and make strategic acquisitions as they race to build out a non-Chinese supply of materials required in high-tech manufacturing. President Trump and Chinese leader Xi Jinping are set to meet on Thursday in South Korea, and rare earths are expected to be high on the agenda. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent said Sunday that he expected Beijing would agree as part of the trade deal to defer certain planned export restrictions on rare earths, but few expect the two leaders to resolve the issue fully. In recent days, Orion Resource Partners, an investment firm specializing in metals, announced a $1.8 billion investment consortium seeded in part with U.S. government money to secure critical minerals for the U.S. and its allies. Earlier last week, Trump and Australian Prime Minister Anthony Albanese signed an agreement to fund critical mineral and rare earth projects. Tied to that announcement, the Export-Import Bank of the United States, a federal agency, announced $2.2 billion in potential financing for seven mineral projects in Australia, and the White House said the Defense Department would invest in an advanced gallium refinery in Western Australia needed for semiconductor manufacturing. J.P. Morgan Chase said earlier this month it would invest $10 billion in companies important to national security, including rare earth companies, part of a $1.5 trillion initiative the bank launched focused on strategic industries. On Monday, the bank announced the first investment, $75 million, for Perpetua Resources, an Idaho-based mining company, that will produce antimony, a key defense material dominated by China. The funding boom suggests China's shock tactics have catalyzed a revival of the Western rare earth industry, much as U.S. efforts to restrict advanced semiconductor exports to China have turbocharged Chinese efforts to catch up with the U.S. in chips. China's awakened the sleeping giant, said John Ormerod, a rare earths industry consultant. Retail and private investors are pouring in billions of dollars of their own. MP Materials, America's flagship rare earth mining company, has seen its share price roughly quadruple this year, raising its market capitalization to around $12 billion. Australian rare earth company Lynas Rare Earths raised about $500 million from investors in August. Its share price has tripled this year. Western critical mineral companies long struggled to raise cash because of their weak position against China's state-backed mineral giants, known for flooding the world with low-cost materials. China's restrictions this year, including a sudden move in October to tighten curbs on rare earth exports, have fundamentally changed the picture. They've made clear that Beijing's control of rare earths isn't a theoretical tool in trade conflicts, but a powerful weapon it will use whenever it feels like hurting the U.S. That's prompted the U.S. to take steps that will build the industry over the long term. One example, the U.S. government agreed to provide a price floor for MP materials so it's protected against any price crash triggered by Chinese overproduction. Ucore Rare Metals, a Canadian rare earth processor, was awarded $18 million by the Pentagon to build its first commercial plant in Louisiana, which will turn raw rare earths into oxides used by many industries. Its stock price has jumped more than 700% this year. We're looking at this as a Manhattan project. You've got to move quickly to get this job done, said Pat Ryan, Ucore's chief executive, who expects to have the plant running next year. Beijing's licensing system, introduced in April, requires foreign companies to get permission before they import powerful rare earth magnets from China. Licenses can take many weeks to go through and are often rejected, frustrating buyers in the automobile, defense, and electronics industries. In June, U.S. leaders said China had agreed to relax magnet restrictions after a trade truce, but some American companies say it's since gotten harder to acquire magnets again, with Chinese rare earth magnet exports to the U.S. declining 29% in September from the month before. International supply chains are geared toward just-in-time and not toward some Beijing bureaucrats making up their minds over months at a time whether to license a particular export shipment or not, said Thomas Kremer, a rare earth analyst based in Singapore. Restoring Western supply chains will take time, and the rare earths industry has seen false dawns before. The industry outside of China is short of experience and expertise. Should the U.S. and China reach a long-term agreement to resume normal trading relations, Western buyers of critical minerals would be tempted to dip back into the Chinese well. This isn't even the end of the beginning. This is the beginning of the beginning, said Oscar Lenovsky, CEO of Orion Resource Partners. Even if the boom has staying power, that doesn't mean every project will succeed. It can be hard for non-specialist investors to distinguish the gems from the duds or predict which companies are in line for government support. The funding surge for a Western supply chain began in July when the U.S. government invested $400 million in MP materials and committed to ensuring buyers for its magnets. Adamas Intelligence, which tracks the rare earths industry, has more than tripled its projections for total U.S. rare earth magnet capacity in 2030. Phoenix Tailings, a New England company that makes rare earth metals and alloys that are used in magnets, opened a factory for rare earth metals in Exeter, New Hampshire in recent days. CEO Nick Mayers wants to add capacity quickly, for which he will need to raise money. Last year, that would have been a daunting prospect. Many potential investors didn't know the importance of obscure rare earth minerals such as praseodymium. Today, Investors have done their research. I don't think anyone in the sector is having a challenge getting private capital, Myers said. That's Investors Chase, U.S. Rare Earths. Turn now to an article by Angel I. Jung. Startup key to AI achieves $10 billion valuation. Mercor, a startup that's become a critical component in the ecosystem, improving top AI models, finalized a new funding deal that would value the company at $10 billion, people familiar with the matter said. That's five times the value the company had in February before it pivoted to one of the more lucrative arenas in the artificial intelligence boom, hiring thousands of white-collar professionals to train the very machines that could one day replace and augment their work. Mercor, which counts OpenAI and Anthropic among its customers, is set to raise $350 million, the people said. Co-founded in 2023 by three college dropouts, Mercor manages 30,000 contractors around the world who label images, write sentences, and provide expert feedback to help AI chatbots learn how to think and speak like humans. Its rapid rise underscores the AI frenzy gripping venture capital firms, where investors are eager to offer funding to founders at sky-high valuations because of fear of missing out on the next AI tech giant. Menlo Park, California-based venture firm Felicius, which led Mercor's last funding round, will lead this one as well, some of the people said. Existing investors like Benchmark and General Catalyst will also participate. Brendan Foody, 22 years old, Mercor's chief executive, met his two other co-founders, Adarsh Hiremath and Surya Midha, while in high school in the Bay Area. Hiremath is the chief technology officer at Mercor, while Midha this month said he was transitioning from chief operating officer to chairman. All three co-founders dropped out a few years into college to start Mercor. Soon after leaving school, they became Thiel Fellows, a program created by venture investor Peter Thiel that funds companies started by college dropouts. Mercor initially started as a human resources and recruiting startup. It used AI to automate resume screening, match candidates with the best role, and screen candidates. It mostly focused on technical jobs ranging from software engineers to mathematicians. As part of this work, the company inadvertently compiled a mass network of specialized workers that the biggest AI companies had become eager to tap to train increasingly sophisticated chatbots and keep up in the AI race. As AI companies sought to improve their models, Mercor quickly scaled up to hire contractors who could evaluate the quality of chatbot answers. To meet the needs of AI companies, Mercor began expanding its network of contractors to include lawyers, doctors, bankers, and journalists. To support this strategy shift, Mercor recruited Uber's former chief product officer, Sundeep Jain, as its first president in May. The value of its network came into focus after Meta Platforms in June paid $14 billion for a 49% stake in Scale AI, one of the most well-known data labeling startups. That pushed Scale's valuation to an astonishing $29 billion. As part of the deal, the company's co-founder and CEO, Alexander Wang, moved to the social media giant to help lead its AI efforts. Some of Scale's customers and competitors raised concerns about the startup's ability to remain neutral and protect customer data after Meta's investment. As a result, the deal became a major boon for rival Mercor. Its revenue has quadrupled since Meta invested in Scale, according to some of the people familiar with its business. The war for talent and business among data labeling startups reached a fever pitch last month when Scale sued Mercor, alleging the company stole trade secrets. It also sued a former Scale employee who had left to work for Mercor. A spokeswoman for Mercor said the company would let the case play out through the legal process. Doctors can now moonlight as data labelers, earning $170 an hour and working a minimum of 20 hours a week in a six-week contract. Tasks include evaluating medical-related answers from AI and reviewing AI-generated medical studies, according to a contract listing posted by the company. And that startup key to AI achieves $10 billion valuation. We'll turn now to the Heard on the Street section of the Wall Street Journal for this item. Microsoft needs to open up on OpenAI. The company's disclosures on its stake in the artificial intelligence startup are scant, but that's no longer tenable. How long can Microsoft expect investors to tolerate big losses from OpenAI without getting antsy? It's hard to say when Microsoft won't even provide a clear number for the size of losses. In its latest annual report for the fiscal year ended June 30th, Microsoft said it included the losses from its OpenAI stake in a $4.7 billion expense line called Other Net. The losses from OpenAI might have been larger than that or smaller. Microsoft didn't say. The expense line combined a hodgepodge of items, positive and negative. Microsoft said its other net expense a year earlier was $1.3 billion. Microsoft said, without elaborating, that the category primarily reflects net recognized losses on equity method investments, including OpenAI. Microsoft also hasn't disclosed the carrying amount for its OpenAI stake, the investment structure, or its fair market value. It said it had reciprocal revenue sharing agreements with OpenAI, but didn't explain how those transactions or others with the ChatGPT developer affected its financial statements, nor has it said what percentage of OpenAI it owns. How Microsoft has managed to avoid disclosing such basic details is baffling. The company, in its financial reports, identifies OpenAI as an equity method investment. That means OpenAI, by definition, is a related party of Microsoft under the accounting rules. Microsoft, however, doesn't identify OpenAI in its financial reports as a related party and doesn't say anything about its transactions with OpenAI in its related party disclosures. The equity method label signifies that Microsoft has the ability to exercise significant influence over OpenAI. The equity method of accounting typically is used when a company has an ownership stake of between 20 and 50%. Microsoft's lack of related party disclosures might have been defensible when OpenAI was relatively small and its value to Microsoft was immaterial, but that's no longer the case. OpenAI recently hit a $500 billion private market valuation after completing a secondary share sale. That could perhaps put the fair value of Microsoft's stake past $100 billion. That's a big number even for Microsoft, where shareholder equity is $343 billion. Microsoft's fiscal 2025 earnings were $102 billion. Adding to the complexity, OpenAI is structured as a nonprofit organization with a for-profit subsidiary. OpenAI has said it plans to overhaul its ownership structure to include a new for-profit company, but many details remain unclear. In a joint statement last month, OpenAI and Microsoft said they were working to finalize terms for the next phase of our partnership. OpenAI is strategically crucial to Microsoft, and some meaningful portion of Microsoft's $3.9 trillion stock market value is now tied to its OpenAI relationship. Under generally accepted accounting principles, companies reporting related party transactions must disclose enough information about them so that an outside reader can gain an understanding of the effects of the transactions on the financial statements. Microsoft is scheduled to report fiscal first quarter earnings on Wednesday. A Microsoft spokeswoman declined to comment. So did a spokesman for OpenAI, which isn't publicly traded and doesn't disclose financial reports. Microsoft's opacity regarding OpenAI has begun to draw criticism as OpenAI has grown in importance. In an October 8th report, Morgan Stanley accounting analysts led by Todd Castagno flagged Microsoft for its lack of related party disclosures regarding OpenAI. When a relationship exists where a company exercises significant influence over its customer, there is a risk that transactions may not be conducted at arm's length, they wrote. Related party disclosures allow investors to evaluate that risk. Disclosures about the stake size are also unsatisfying. In its annual report, Microsoft said, "We have an investment in OpenAI, and have made total funding commitments of $13 billion. It didn't say how much it had invested, even though it publicly announced an initial $1 billion investment in 2019, or how much of the commitments it had funded. The Wall Street Journal reported in October 2024 that Microsoft had invested $13.75 billion in OpenAI since 2019. Microsoft doesn't use the fair value of OpenAI shares to value its stake. Instead, under the equity method, it reduces the carrying amount based on its proportionate share of OpenAI's losses. Its losses would be capped once the carrying amount fell to zero, while any new investments in OpenAI would increase the carrying amount. Whatever the carrying amount was, it didn't exceed $6 billion as of June 30th. That's what Microsoft reported for its total equity method investments. That was the same as a year earlier. One concern for investors is that OpenAI's losses could widen as it invests heavily in computing infrastructure, but revenue growth lags behind. That, in turn, would likely increase the pressure on Microsoft to provide more details about the relationship. Microsoft has a chance with its next quarterly report to open up about OpenAI and start reporting their dealings in its related party disclosures. Even if it could still rationalize that its transactions with OpenAI are quantitatively insignificant, there is no denying that the overall relationship with OpenAI is quite material. Investors want and need to know more. And that's Microsoft Needs to Open Up on OpenAI, an item from Heard on the Street by Jonathan Weil. You've been listening to Wall Street Journal here on Sun Sounds of Arizona with your volunteer reader, Chuck Kaufman. Remember, you can listen to the Wall Street Journal and other Sun Sounds of Arizona programming as it streams or at a time of your choosing. Just go to the Sun Sounds of Arizona website at sunsounds.org or download the Sun Sounds of Arizona app. And that's available for your iPhone or iPad from the Apple App Store or for your Android phone or tablet from the Google Play Store. And of course, you can always listen to Sun Sounds of Arizona streaming on your Amazon Dot or Echo.